The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Masterclasses at PAFA offer students the opportunity to work with nationally and internationally recognized artists, from classical figure drawing with Juliet Aristides, pastel portraiture with Ellen Eagle, abstract painting with Jan Baltzel, to plein air seascapes in Cape May, New Jersey, with Joe Sweeney, and more. Registration is now underway for summer classes. Details online at pafa.org/masterclasses.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll consider why the November Philadelphia mayoral race might be a little unusual. First, one of the most striking things about former Philadelphia City Councilman Jim Kenney's landslide win over State Senator Anthony Williams in yesterday's Democratic mayoral primary is the support that Kenney, an Irish-American from South Philadelphia, received from African-American voters. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that Kenney's success represents a groundbreaking level of voters crossing racial lines when casting ballots.
The first sign that something different was brewing in this mayor's race came in April, when five African-American elected officials in Northwest Philadelphia endorsed Kenney for mayor. That prompted a retort from some black leaders supporting Williams. One, Attorney George Burrell, said some of the city's early African-American political leaders would be turning over in their graves to see black leaders endorsing Kenney. One of those who backed Kenney, State Representative Sherelle Parker, said Tuesday that inspired her and others to make sure they turned out a vote for their candidate.
I think members of our community were insulted by the idea that anyone would think that they were automatically entitled to their votes just because. And Jim Kenney sort of used that as an opportunity to say, I'm here to earn your vote.
Parker spoke at a polling place in the 50th Ward in East Mount Airy. When the returns came in, Kenney had beaten Williams in that ward by a 2-1 margin. Dorothy Coleman, an elderly African-American woman from the neighborhood, said she voted for Kenney in part on the recommendation of Parker and City Councilwoman Marion Tasco.
I didn't know much about him, but they gave me a lot of information prior to the election. Yeah, Tasco said she sat beside him for 23 years. I take her word for it.
The results citywide stunned the city's political community. While his backers hoped Kenney would get a respectable slice of the black vote, maybe better than the estimated 15% Ed Rendell won in 1991, no one expected him to win black wards outright. An analysis of unofficial returns shows Kenney won 9 out of 19 predominantly black wards in the city. Williams ran strongest in his state Senate district. Neil Oxman is a veteran political consultant who worked for the city's first black mayor, Wilson Good, and its current one, Michael Nutter. He says Kenney's strong showing among black voters is significant and builds on the trend of crossover racial voting that emerged in 2007 when many white voters supported Nutter.
I think the city is past the situation we were in the 60s and 70s and 80s, where you had a really polarizing figure like Frank Rizzo, where there had never been an African-American elected mayor, and where the African-American community felt a gigantic stake in making sure that they were represented.
Oxman, who made ads for a super PAC supporting Kenney in this race, says African-American voters felt free to choose the candidate that seemed best prepared, and to many, it was Kenney. George Burrell, the attorney and former mayoral candidate who objected to Parker and Tasco endorsing Kenney, has a different take on the result. He says black voters who've elected three African-American mayors aren't satisfied with what they've gotten.
I think there's a frustration, particularly in poor communities, in the black community, in the Hispanic community. I think that people have said, you know, we've done this for a long time and we haven't gotten the change that we're looking for.
Charmaine Matlock-Turner, president of the Urban Affairs Coalition, agrees black voters feel less compelled to vote for an African-American than they did years ago and thinks one reason Kenney did well this time has nothing to do with race. She says members of Congress or the state legislature, like Williams, have a harder time appealing to voters in a mayoral election than someone like Kenney, who was a fixture on city council.
It gives them an advantage when they are running in the city where they have to talk about issues that people in the community have been hearing them talk about for a long period of time.
One thing all agree on, Kenney faces a challenge in meeting the hopes and aspirations of those who supported him. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Following yesterday's win, Kenny celebrated his victory with the Republican nominee, Melissa Murray Bailey. And as WHYY's Katie Culinary reports, that wasn't the only unusual thing about his post-primary party.
While other politicos gathered at the upscale Palm restaurant, as is tradition in Philadelphia, Kenny had his post-primary steak lunch at a fundraiser for the Broad Street Ministry. Attendees included the ministry's homeless and hungry guests, as well as Governor Tom Wolf. Kenny told the crowd that dealing with the city's high poverty rate is on his agenda.
And it always marvels me that when people are homeless and on the street, we somehow don't have the same attitude about their plight as we do about our own neighbors in our neighborhood.
Kenny also invited his Republican challenger, Melissa Murray Bailey, who is the underdog in this overwhelmingly Democratic city.
I want to make it clear to you that I am not a sacrificial lamb, that the Republican Party promised something in return for being here.
Former councilman and Kenny rival Bill Green has not ruled out an independent run for mayor in the fall. But Green says he already has a strategy for beating Kenny.
If you've been part of the system for 35 years, it's hard to believe that if the populace understood that, that they would think that you would put the city on the right track.
Kenny, who promised a civil race against Bailey for the general election, had this to say about Green possibly jumping into the race.
If he wants to run, he can run. You know, it's America.
Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Three billionaires spent more than $6 million to support Philadelphia candidates for school choice in yesterday's Democratic primary. At the polls, voters instead pushed buttons for public education stalwarts like Helen Gim. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has the story of how education played out in the races.
Boys Latin Charter CEO David Hardy allegedly sent a letter to his staff to vote for Anthony Hardy Williams for mayor and not Helen Gim for city council.
Did you see the letter? Because anybody who saw the letter would have realized that it was like tongue-in-cheek, the whole thing. I sent that to my staff. I didn't send that out for public consumption because it was a joke.
Jokes aside, Hardy says he thinks average parents were not represented in the voting. Pennsylvania Coalition of Public Charters Board President Larry Jones says turnout was too low to draw any conclusions about which education policies the public wants.
The voter impact, the voter turnout was more of a referendum on the entire city. I don't think it was necessarily a referendum on school choice or public education.
Only around one in four Philadelphians eligible to vote in this primary did. Even so, Helen Gim, who dislodged an incumbent in the city council primary, is taking her success as proof that voters want change.
I do think that there was a significant statement made in the municipal election that public education in particular and an emphasis on neighborhoods was going to have a huge play in how the electorate was going to see its elected officials.
She says fighting to make school funding a year-round conversation in council will be a top priority. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Pennsauken Township could save more than $5 million a year by turning over law enforcement to Camden County Police. Though the savings would come in the form of fewer officers and lower salaries, as WHYY's Steve Trader found out.
After watching the success Camden City found cutting crime while saving money, Pennsauken Mayor Rick Taylor says it's his financial responsibility to look at the numbers. So he agreed to look over research commissioned by Camden County officials.
We're not doing anything clandestine or behind anyone's back. It's just a pipe dream. It's nothing assured.
Pennsauken Police Captain Thomas Connor sees it more as a sales pitch and says he's concerned that cuts would mean diminished service to residents.
Our police department was studied from a distance and that some data that was unreliable was used to arrive at certain conclusions. But to my knowledge, no officer in this police department was ever spoken to about the operations of this police department.
Camden freeholder Louis Capelli says department resources would remain separate. He says the issues of lower salaries and department turnover would have to be addressed.
Other municipalities are learning that our officers are well-trained and prepared, and they've become a very valuable commodity. Our officers are sought after by other municipalities because they are that good.
Pennsauken Police recently extended their contract, but that could be overruled by the township. For WHYY News, I'm Steve Trader.
Taking a look at today's headlines, Philadelphia City Council's website has been restored after a hacking incident replaced news about legislation with text on a black screen criticizing the site's security. The site was fixed late this morning after being disabled for several hours. It's not clear who's responsible, although a message posted during the attack attributed it to a group calling itself Saib 3R Commandos. The message described the group as an international underground hacking team and made references to Islam and Israel. No other city websites were affected. A former New York Jets linebacker has pleaded guilty to three charges in connection with an incident that invoked New Jersey's revenge porn law. At a hearing in state superior court today, Jermaine Cunningham pleaded guilty to invasion of privacy, illegal transport of a weapon, and possession of hollow point bullets. Authorities have said the charges stem from a domestic dispute at a residence on December 29th. An investigation revealed that Cunningham had posted a racy photo of his estranged girlfriend online without her consent. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie signs an executive order aimed at better protecting the state from cybersecurity threats. He signed it this afternoon at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness in Hamilton. The order establishes the New Jersey Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Cell. That new entity is intended to serve as a hub for sharing information, analyzing potential threats, and coordinating with federal law enforcement officials. 66 degrees, partly cloudy skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clouding up overnight, low 48 degrees. Still ahead, the 76ers have high hopes for the upcoming season, even though the best-case scenario eluded them in last night's draft lottery.
The days of being a tanking 15-win team are finished.
Newsworks Tonight bolsters its bench on WHYY.
Chamber of Commerce of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware supports WHYY. On Wednesday, May 27th at the First District Plaza, the Chamber is hosting its 2015 annual meeting and awards gala. Joined by billionaire developer R. Donahue Peebles and more than 600 business leaders, this event will celebrate the success of African American businesses and organizations working to build the African American business community. Details at aachamber.org.
Every day on Morning Edition, it's the news you can't do without.
This morning, we've been looking at what's happening.
There's conservatism, libertarianism, environmentalism, religion.
We're not props. We're just everyday people.
The crowd, the joy, the sense of hope.
Historic.
Listen to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us for NPR's Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on WHYY.
The Delaware Art Museum supports WHYY and presents Elliot Erwitt, Dog Dogs, through May 24th. There is no love like the love of man's best friend. Photojournalist Elliot Erwitt recorded the relationship between humans and their canine companions through beautifully composed black and white photographs of tiny chihuahuas, inquisitive poodles, and glaring bulldogs from around the world. For more information, 302-571-9590 or delart.org.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Call it a saxophone colossus. On Friday, the famed Philadelphia-based Prism Quartet will present world premieres of new saxophone quartets at the Curtis Institute of Music. The program includes a composition by Montgomery County native Julia Wolf. Let's tap into the sound with Julia, composer, co-founder, and co-artistic director of New York's music collective Bang on a Can. She also serves on the composition faculty of the NYU Steinhardt School. And let's meet Matt Levy, Prism Quartet tenor sax player. Matt, Julia, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Julia, before we get to the program at hand on Friday, let's certainly note that you took the Pulitzer Prize last month for a composition called Anthracite Fields. Talk about that piece of music.
I grew up in Montgomeryville. And if you took a long country road called Billsmeyer Road all the way up to Route 309, if you turn left, you'd be heading north in, up towards coal country, which is Scranton and Wilkes-Barre. And when I received a commission from the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia, I thought, well, this is interesting. It's my very first commission from my home state, and Prism is my second.
So I thought, let me look to the region. I looked northward towards this whole area where coal was the industry that basically powered the nation for many, many years. And so it was almost like a little history project, a little research project. And it was fascinating. So turned into text, turned into music, and it's a really, really very moving project.
Now, certainly no text in this piece that Prism Quartet will be performing.
Yes, but there is a subtext. I'd always wanted to write a piece in memory of my dad, who has passed in recent years. But I thought about one particular memory, which was my dad loved to dance, and I remember him pulling me onto the dance floor at various celebrations and doing the cha-cha, and a very suburban version of the cha-cha, I'm sure. But still, that sense of joy and rhythm, and I tried to capture some of that spirit in this piece, which is called Cha. There's definitely a nod to salsa and cha-cha rhythms, so really wonderful Cuban syncopated type rhythms. The rhythms that then go manic, and that's what's so great about Prism. I thought, well, these guys have unbelievable chops. I can really have them bouncing off each other rhythmically, and they're just going to nail it, and they did.
Julia, Matt in studio with me is grinning broadly, and Matt, certainly the diversity of musical styles that Julia refers to is consonant with Prism sound as well, no mere classical saxophone quartet.
We embrace many kinds of music, and Julia is kind of emblematic of a composer who is really, you know, we're sort of on the same wavelength. You know, her music touches on all kinds of vernacular and folkloric music, and we love it. You know, we just eat it up. It's fun, and it's really meaningful.
In addition to Cha, what are some of the other pieces on the agenda that evening?
We call it wall-to-wall world premieres because it's 10 pieces that have never been played or premiered. There's a piece by a wonderful young composer who's just finished up at Curtis named David Hertzberg. He wrote a piece that tries to capture the essence of starlings in flocks that sort of form these interesting shapes that are called murmurations. It looks like a single organism, but it's hundreds or thousands of birds flying, you know, kind of in unison. Many of these pieces try and capture kind of extra musical material or ideas.
We've touched on Prism, but Julia, for listeners who perhaps aren't familiar with Bang on a Can, describe that project.
Basically, it started as a festival. Three composers, me, Michael Gordon, and David Lang, came out of school and weren't sure where we'd fit in. And so we started a festival, a 12-hour, one-day festival of all kinds of adventurous music back-to-back. That was in 1987, so over the years it's grown to kind of address different areas of new music. There's a Summer Institute, a commissioning program, a record label that's kind of an offshoot of it. Yeah, just different ways of providing a touring ensemble, ways of providing opportunities to get new music out into the world.
You know, actually, Bang on a Can is in many ways our model. We've sort of done a similar sort of thing where we have different programs that we use to disseminate and commission new music. We're starting our own label as well. You know, we have commissioning programs. We have educational outreach. We self-present concerts in New York City and Philadelphia, and we're branching out to Detroit and Ann Arbor and hopefully into Chicago as well.
Julia, Matt, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Julia Wolf and tenor saxophonist Matt Levy of the Prism Quartet. You can hear more of our conversation and more of their music at newsworks.org. For a struggling NBA franchise, the draft lottery can be more important than the draft itself. It's when teams learn what order they'll pick who they hope will be the league's next superstar to lead them to brighter days. As WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports, last night's draft lottery was good, but not great for the 76ers' rebuilding efforts.
For two seasons, the Sixers have intentionally lived at the bottom of the NBA with a hope that all those losses would lead them to the number one overall pick in the NBA draft. that plan failed to pan out. They also missed an opportunity, albeit a small one, to have a total of 3 first-round selections. Instead, the Sixers will have just the 3rd pick during the NBA draft in June. Eric Goldwein is editor of Hoop 76, a Sixers blog run by ESPN. He says, yeah, the Sixers would have loved to get the 1st pick, but it's not the end of the world.
In a draft where I don't really see one clear-cut, can't-miss prospect, I don't think it's a bad thing.
As for whether the team will be any better in the next season, Goldwein says yes.
They, at this point, have collected too many prospects to be that bad, and eventually they will presumably start spending, and I think if it's not this year, it'll be next. And I think the days of being a tanking 15-win team are finished.
At 18-64, the Sixers had the league's 3rd worst record. Goldwein predicts they could win 30 or more games this time, enough in a weak Eastern Conference to potentially make the playoffs. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
And finally this evening, hey, want to hear a pizza joke? Never mind, it's too cheesy. Well, if your kid's humor falls along those lines, the United Healthcare Children's Foundation wants to hear from them. They're collecting children's favorite puns, knock-knock jokes, and riddles for 2 upcoming joke books, set to be released October 2nd, which happens to be World Smile Day. Young comedians have the chance to be published and also help local children in need. In addition to being given out to hospitalized children, the books are sold to generate revenue for grants to help families pay for their child health care needs. Last year, the foundation published its 1st joke book entitled Little Book, Big Laughs Joke Book that contained more than 600 jokes for kids submitted by kids. Until the end of the month, children 17 and under can submit their jokes to the website uhccf.org. That's all for tonight's show, and that's no joke. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Brett Rader. Listen again to a story, or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Bryn Mawr Rehab supports WHYY and for more than 40 years has been committed to delivering advanced physical rehab services to those recovering from serious illness or injury. Their team of specialists develops customized inpatient and outpatient treatment plans for a range of conditions, including brain injury, spinal cord injury, concussion, and stroke. Patients travel from across the country for Bryn Mawr Rehab Hospital's creativity and personalized therapeutic approach. Learn more, including real patient stories, at mainlinehealth.org/rehab.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners to discover how a master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling can help prepare adults for professional licensure and roles in community counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. There's an information session on June 3rd at Newman's campus in Delaware County. Details are available at Newman.